Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Then we continue with an internet Ask Me Anything. All the questions have come to us via the internet. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and many other things. The proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Thanks for being back for another hour, Jimmy.
Yeah, my pleasure. By the way, during the break, I looked up the title of that book that I mentioned last hour by the paranthropologist Jack Hunter, and it's called Deep Weird, The Varieties of High Strangeness Experience, and it's an anthology, so he's got different authors writing in it. But my experience when I read it was, I've heard weirder. This isn't particularly deeply weird to me.
Deep Weird. It's a good title though. As a matter of fact, that could be a nickname. I got to think of who I can apply that nickname to. Not you, Darren. You're not deep weird. You're not now. All right. Back to the internet. We go for our questions. We got a bunch of them, for Jimmy. This one comes from Brady.
Darren might be pleasantly weird.
Yes. Yeah. Look at that, yeah. Darren. He seems so satisfied with that as his nickname. He seems genuinely happy that that's his nickname. Brady asked this, what is the history of the use of the Tetragrammaton / divine name in worship, particularly as it relates to Jehovah's Witnesses?
Okay, so the Tetragrammaton, that literally means, based on its etymology, the four letters, and it's a reference to the four Hebrew consonants that are used to spell God's name in the Old Testament. The English equivalents, in Hebrew, it's Yud He Vav He, or Yud He Wow He, depending on the pronunciation scheme you're using. The English equivalents are YHWH. And it's believed by scholars that those were most probably pronounced Yahweh early in Israelite history. However, after the Babylonian exile, Jews started pronouncing it less and less frequency. And so by about the 200s BC, they really weren't using the name, and they weren't saying it out the way they had previously. In worship, there were some situations, like I remember hearing that, like, there's one day of the year, it may have been the Day of Atonement, when the priest would still pronounce it, but it was basically gone from regular discourse. So if you had, now that created an issue, because they read the Torah every Sabbath in the synagogue, and the divine name's right there in the text. So they would come up with substitute terms. And the main substitute term was Adonai, which means my Lord. And so they would, whenever they'd be reading along, and whenever they'd hit the Tetragrammaton, they'd just say Adonai instead. Well, so that was the situation at the time of the writing of the New Testament, you know, in the Second Temple period, which is why in the New Testament, we don't find the Tetragrammaton or a spelled out version of God's name in Greek letters. Instead, what they do is they use, and they even use this word when they are quoting from the Old Testament. In the New Testament, you know, it'll say, as the prophet so-and-so said this. And if the divine name appears in the quotation, they replace it with the Greek equivalent of Adonai, which is Kurios. Kurios means Lord in Greek. So it's basically the same. It's not my Lord the way it is in Hebrew, but it's basically the same concept, Lord. And so then history rolls along, the New Testament gets written, and by the Middle Ages, a system of vowel points was created for the Hebrew language. Now, Hebrew, going back to, you know, to 1000 BC, had consonants, but they didn't have vowels. And so what they did when they came up with vowels is they made them, for the most part, little small points or marks that they would put above, below, or in the middle of letters, of consonants. And so these are known as the vowel points. They're just little marks that tell you what vowel you should say after this consonant. And so by the 1100s, the scholars who came up with the primary system of vowel pointing, they're known as the Masoretes, they added the vowel points of Adonai to the biblical text where it says the divine name. So you've got the consonants of Yahweh with the vowel points of Adonai. And the vowel points were there to remind you, don't say the divine name, say Adonai instead, if you're a lector mm-hmm. reading this out in the synagogue. But what happened was by the 1500s, people would read the consonants of Yahweh and the vowel points of Adonai as if it was a single real word. And that gave us Yahovah or Jehovah. And so by the 1500s, Jehovah came into existence as a name that people would use for God. And in the 1900s, the Jehovah's Witnesses mandated the use of Jehovah as the name for God in their religious group. So you're supposed to say Jehovah, and they think that this is necessary because we're supposed to magnify God's name, and to them that means literally using a version of his name. However, I would say, you know, I understand why you're wanting to do that, but it's actually not required, because the New Testament authors didn't do this. The New Testament was written in the period when Jews, were, including the first Jewish Christians, were not saying Yahweh or Jehovah or any version of the divine name. They were saying Adonai, and that's why in the Greek New Testament, it never uses the divine name. It uses Kurios, which means Lord. So Jesus and the apostles weren't going around talking about Yahweh or Jehovah all the time. They were talking about the Lord. And so consequently, I think the Jehovah's Witnesses attitude on this is misplaced, because it was not shared by Jesus and the authors of the New Testament.
All righty. Thank you very much for the question, Brady. Jerry asks this. I heard your show where you mentioned a study in India on near-death experiences, where the people in India would see some spirits that were either good or evil spirits. Christians see angels, good or bad. So non-believers could argue that the fact that people don't see the same thing is proof that these visions are due only to chemical reactions of a dying brain. How would you respond?
Well, okay, so first of all, people coming from a Christian context do sometimes see demons when they have near-death experiences. There are what are known as distressing near-death experiences. They account for something like a fifth or 20% of near-death experiences. And in distressing ones, people do report seeing demons. So they both report seeing good angels and bad angels in their experiences. When we look at the Indian experiences, and the name of this book, by the way, is At the Hour of Death. I want to say it's by Erlander Haroldson and I'm blanking on the other author's name. But in any event, they did this study, and in India, people would see, you know, I mentioned how in the previous hour, how in deathbed visions and near-death experiences, people will see these spirits either of departed loved ones or angels or something like angels coming to escort them into the afterlife. Well, in India, the spirits they refer to as doing this are called Yamduts. Yama is the personification of death, and so the messengers that Yama sends are called Yamduts. And the Yamduts themselves are angels. They're called messengers of death, and messenger is what the word angel means. So these are angels of death, and they're not perceived as being bad. Some of them are frightening. If you've lived a bad life, your Yamduts may be frightening to you. If you've lived a good life, your Yamduts may be beautiful and pleasant, but that's no different than angels, because angels in the Bible can be pleasant or they can be scary. You know, I mean, God used the angel of death to take care of the Egyptian firstborn. I mean, that's scary, you know, and he had an angel smiting Israel with a plague in the time of King David. So just because something's scary or dangerous doesn't mean it's not good. So I would say that the people in India are seeing the same thing in their experiences of deathbed visions and near-death experiences. They're just interpreting them differently. They have different names and images in their culture, and that influences how they perceive these entities. But that doesn't tell us anything one way or another about, is a dying brain producing this experience? People both in America and in India report seeing spirits that are not human that perform the same function, escorting people into the afterlife. And, you know, in normal life, you know, we can perceive things slight that we see around us as, you know, in terms of our cultural background and the names we have for things. And we regard that, if we're seeing the same thing doing the same function, we just call it by different names based on our culture, then we would say, well, the experience is fundamentally accurate. You know, if I see a tree and someone from another culture sees the same tree, even if we call it different things and we notice different things about it because of our culture and our previous history, if we're both seeing the tree, then that's that's evidence that our experience is objectively real. And so if both Christians and Hindus are seeing these non-human spirits showing up to escort you to the afterlife, they're fundamentally seeing the same thing. And that would suggest this is an objectively real experience of the world and not simply something that's conjured up by a dying brain any more than the tree we both see is conjured up by a living brain.
Jerry, thanks for the question. That takes us right to the break. Right back with more Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
On Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Father Joseph and Doug Keck mind decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. Mother dishes out teaching, advice, laughter, and plenty of prayers as she takes calls from her family.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live. It's an Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour. Lots of internet questions for Jimmy. Jimmy, you wanted to say something about a book that you mentioned before.
Yeah. So in case anybody wants to look it up, that book I mentioned is called At the Hour of Death. And the co-authors, I mentioned one of them, Erlander Haraldson. The other is Carlos Osis. And so if you want to look it up and read about the study that was done in these two nations, it's At the Hour of Death by Erlander Haraldson and Carlos Osis.
All righty. This one comes from Ryan. What would be the best way for us Catholics to answer some Protestants who claim what's happening in Israel right now has to do with the second coming of Jesus and that in their minds is going to happen soon or at any moment?
Well, I wouldn't dismiss the reformation of Israel after 1800 years as having no prophetic significance. I mean, when the Jewish people suddenly gets its land back after all that time, okay, that suggests to me a notable event in the history of Israel as God's people. And so I would say that that's a sign that we're closer to the end than we were before. However, that still doesn't tell us we're close to the end. And in particular, I'm skeptical of claims about it's going to happen any time now. Ever since Israel reformed in 1948, there has been a history of bad prophetic interpretations in this area. For example, a lot of people prior to 1988 would say, oh, well, a biblical generation is 40 years long, and Jesus said that. Now, he was really talking about the destruction of the temple, but a lot of people in the evangelical world took him as referring to the end of the world. He said this is going to happen within this generation, and so what he meant is the temple's going to be destroyed within a generation of when he said that in AD 33, and it was destroyed in AD 70. But a lot of people have misread that as him talking about the end of the world, and so they said, oh, so within a generation of Israel reforming, the world's going to end. And a generation biblically they would say is 40 years, well, in some passages, but not in others. And so they would say, therefore, since Israel is now reformed, we've got less than 40 years till the second coming. So the second coming is going to happen by 1988. And people like in the evangelical world, like Hal Lindsey, would write books like The Late Great Planet Earth and Satan is Alive and Well on Planet Earth and things like that. And they were predicting that Armageddon would happen by the 1980s, you know, that there'd be this big war in the Middle East and Russia would get involved and all this stuff in the Middle East in the 1980s. And none of that happened. So there's a history of failed predictions regarding Israel. And there are also problems with the overall prophetic system. A lot of these predictions were based on a prophetic interpretation known as dispensational premillennialism, which unfortunately is a false system. And so a lot of these predictions came out of this false prophetic system that now is being rethought in a bunch of areas in evangelicalism. The only sure sign that we have from Scripture for when the second coming is going to be near does involve the Jewish people, but it's not the reformation of Israel. I think the reformation of Israel is notable, but it's not the sign that the second coming is going to happen. That sign is referred to in Romans chapter 11, and St. Paul indicates that there's going to be some kind of large-scale conversion of the Jewish people to Christ. And he says that is going to signal life from the dead. That's the real thing that tells us the resurrection is about to happen. So until that happens, until we see a large-scale conversion of the Jewish population to Christianity, I would say the second coming is still in our future.
All right, Ryan. I hope that one was helpful to you. Let's go to John David's question. What allegedly evidential near-death experience do you think is the strongest?
Okay, well, there are actually a bunch of strong, they're often called veridical near-death experiences. But what that means is there's good evidence that this was a real objective experience. And they involve different factors, like the person who dies and then comes back, or almost dies and then comes back with knowledge they didn't have before that can be verified. There are other ways that NDEs can be validated, but that's the principal way. And I plan to do a future episode of Mysterious World on this. In fact, currently the best book on veridical near-death experiences is called The Self Does Not Die, and it's by a researcher named Titus Rivas and several others. But the book is called The Self Does Not Die, and what they do in it is they give like over 100 accounts where someone died or almost died and then came back with knowledge or something else that would confirm the objectivity of their experience and that had witnesses. So it's not just someone came back and said all this stuff happened, but there were witnesses involved who could vouch for this. It's not like there have been some books that have been published. In fact, if you see a book about a near-death experience and the whole book focuses on one near-death experience, you want to be suspicious because there's been a history of those being fake. An example would be there was a boy named Malarkey, ironically, who was the basis of a book called The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven. And he later denounced the book and said, my dad, I made it up to get attention, and my dad pushed it into this book, and I didn't understand what he was doing, and it's all fake. And the publisher, it was an evangelical publisher, pulled the book from the market. Anytime you see a book that focuses on one person's near-death experience, there's significant profit and attention motive there. And those have a track record of not being that reliable. So I don't put a lot of stock in what one person says long after the experience. But in The Self Does Not Die, what Rivas and the other researchers do is they look at cases where there was early documentation. Like someone comes back from getting their heart restarted and they immediately start talking to the hospital personnel before anything has been verified. And so you've got witnesses to the claim before the verification efforts are made. And there are a number of really good veridical NDEs in the book. And the weight of all of them, just experience after experience that can be documented this way, is a powerful case. But if I was going to pick one, the one that I think is easiest to convey to, at least at the moment, the one I think that's easiest to convey to a person who's not a specialist in this area, is the story of Maria Hsu. This experience occurred a few decades ago up in the Northwest here in America. There was a migrant worker from Mexico named Maria who had a cardiac arrest, and she was brought into the hospital by ambulance. So it's not like she got to walk around the hospital or anything. If memory serves, she also came in at night, and she cardiac arrested in the hospital. And she had an out-of-body experience, which is typical for NDEs. And in her out-of-body experience, she saw, the doctors and nurses working on her, but then she started moving around the rest of the hospital. And one of the things she saw in her out-of-body experience was a men's blue tennis shoe with scraping on one side of it and a shoelace tucked under it on a ledge outside a room on a different floor of the hospital. And then they get her heart restarted. She's back in her body, and instantly, now she didn't really speak English, so they had to find a hospital worker who knew some Spanish, and which at the time was harder than it would be now. And they got one of the hospital workers who knew some Spanish to come in and talk to her. She's really animated. She's insistent about, I just saw this shoe on a ledge outside a hospital room on a different floor. Can you go find it? Because she wanted to know, is my experience real or was that all a hallucination? So the hospital worker started going around, and on an upper floor of the hospital, this is not ground level, on an upper floor of the hospital, the nurse found a men's tennis shoe with blue with scuffing and a shoelace tucked underneath it, and was able to even get out on the ledge and retrieve the shoe and bring it back to Maria and say, you weren't hallucinating. Here's the shoe. And so here we've got this veridical experience with knowledge that Maria didn't have before she had the cardiac arrest. We've got a witness who, because it wasn't Maria who went and found the shoe, it was this hospital worker. And we have the shoe itself, at least we did for a long time. The hospital worker eventually lost it when she moved. But there are photographs of the shoe because she did like TV interviews about this. So I think the story of Maria Hsu is a particularly compelling near-death experience in evidential terms.
Wow. John, thank you very much for the question. It's an internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour. Let's go to Matthew's question. If the Pope has the keys to heaven and hell, could the Pope Church canonize someone that God would not have allowed into heaven by ordinary means, but since the church pope utilized the authority of those keys, they now get in? What about the reverse? A just person going to hell because the church invoked the keys of authority to condemn them?
Okay, so the image of Peter having the keys comes from Matthew chapter 16, and he's often pictured having the keys in Christian art. But this refers to the Pope being able to pass laws for the church here on earth. It does not mean that the Pope can include or exclude someone from heaven or hell. Pope doesn't control that. What controls that is the person's own choices. If the person either goes to heaven or doesn't go to heaven based on what the person did during their life, the Pope does not control that. Consequently, the Pope cannot include someone in heaven who otherwise wouldn't have gotten there, nor can he exclude someone from heaven who deserved to go there. The church never canonizes anyone as going to hell. And then in terms of, I believe Matthew asked about, you know, what do we know about canonizations? Like, are they certain? Whether or not saint canonizations are infallible is a disputed question. So that's kind of a sketch of this overall area. But the Pope is not going to get someone into heaven who is otherwise damned, and he's not going to exclude from heaven someone who is otherwise saved.
Matthew, thank you for the question. It's an internet Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We've got a whole bunch of questions from the internet, and there'll be a whole bunch more coming right after this on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns to the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Join special guests Scott and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and an all-star lineup of speakers September 26th through 29th. Spend time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and our special guests right here in beautiful San Diego. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's an internet Ask Me Anything. Lots of questions for Jimmy from the internet. And here comes more of them. Mary wants to know this. From what I understand, the Jesuits are not allowed to hold positions of authority or power. Is this true? And if so, did it change to permit Pope Francis to be Pope?
Okay, so there are Jesuits who have positions of authority and power, like the provincial of the Jesuit order, but Jesuits generally are not named as bishops. And the reason for that is there's a tradition in the Jesuit order going back to Ignatius of Loyola, their founder, who emphasized vocations as being a service. And thus, as a humble thing, he didn't want his members of his order clerical social climbing, you know, trying to climb up the ranks and become bishops and cardinals and things like that. Having said that, generally they are not named bishops because they tend to decline when you ask them. But there are exceptions, and sometimes the Vatican will ask a Jesuit to become a bishop. And they did that for Jorge Bergoglio back in 1992. He was a Jesuit priest. He was asked to become a bishop, and he did. He accepted. He may have had to get permission from the Jesuit provincial, but he became a bishop, and eventually he became a cardinal, and eventually he became pope.
And there's that. Mary, thanks very much. This one comes from Keith. Maybe better for a Weird Questions episode, but I recently had several blessed holy objects go missing around the house. And it occurred to me, what if it was demons? Is there anything to believe that demons couldn't move holy objects?
Well, demons are just bad angels, and angels have the ability of mind over matter. They can control matter with their mind since they don't have a physical body to control matter with. And so that's what's known as psychokinesis. So, bad angels have the same psychokinetic abilities as good angels. And thus, there's nothing in principle that couldn't stop a demon from moving a holy object, But there is some reason to question whether they'd actually do that, because demons are disinclined to interact with the holy. That's one of the notable things about demons, and this is one of the diagnostic criteria in exorcism cases, is that they are averse to the holy. They really don't like hearing the name of Jesus or seeing pictures of Mary or things like that. And so if you've got, let's say, a blessed rosary or a blessed holy card or something like that, a demon's natural inclination is going to be to stay away from that because it's hard for them to interact with holiness. And in fact, that's my theory about what the principal mechanism of exorcism is. If it were as simple as demons obey rules and so you just put up an eviction notice on the person, they ought to leave immediately. But demons are rule breakers, and so it seems that something else, and they don't leave immediately. And so it seems that something else is going on in an exorcism. And one of the things that historically has been found is that that demons find various things the exorcist is doing to be painful. In fact, the 1614 rite of exorcism actually says that the exorcist should figure out, in the case of a particular demon, what's hurting it the most and do more of that. And so my theory of what makes exorcism work is it's essentially a holiness overload, that the demon can't stand this much holiness, and eventually it decides it's just going to leave to avoid the holiness. So it would be unexpected for a demon to be moving holy objects. Having said that, and this is something I always caution people, just because you could explain something by demons doesn't mean it's demons. So don't leap to the demon hypothesis. You need to consider the full range of possibilities for what could account for a phenomenon like objects being moved. In fact, there are multiple parapsychological phenomena that involve this. Classically, if an object appears, when it wasn't there before, that's called apportation. If an object appears, if an object disappears from one location, it's called asportation. There are some more modern names, though. These days, one of the common names for this is disappearing object phenomena. They're also sometimes called jots. Jot, J-O-T-T, stands for just one of those things. It's this mysterious, this object moved, and it's just one of those things, so it's a jot. Also, in poltergeist cases, which are commonly explained as not a spirit moving stuff, but as the subconscious of a person under stress moving stuff, poltergeist cases are famous for causing objects to move. So those are just parapsychological explanations in addition to demons. But then there's all the natural phenomena that can explain the same thing, like you moved it and you forgot because humans have fallible memories, or someone else in your household moved it, or maybe your pet moved it, or maybe it rolled to a new location on its own, or maybe the wind blew it, or any number of different things. So in any investigation, you always want to start with the natural explanations, because normal explanations are more common than paranormal ones. And so you want to start with, could something natural explain this? You only want to resort to paranormal explanations, which would include demons, when none of the natural explanations are good. And you only want to go to demons when you have actual evidence it's demons, as opposed to something else.
Thanks, Keith. I hope you find them. Shannon asks this, Jimmy. She says this is from her 15-year-old. Is God alive both scientifically as well as theologically?
Well, so to answer the question, I need to know a little bit more about what does the 15-year-old mean by alive? Because that could be taken to mean exist, or it could mean to have biological life. Well, okay, let's take the first of those options. Could we show that God exists both scientifically as well as theologically? Well, there are arguments for God's existence. Normally, these arguments are considered philosophical rather than scientific, but there are arguments for God's existence that incorporate material from the natural sciences. Some of these are, for example, what are known as design arguments that say it looks like the world was designed because it has these certain characteristics that you wouldn't expect to happen just randomly. It looks like our universe is intelligently designed to make life possible. And some of those factors are things that are sometimes called cosmological constants. They're quantities in nature, like the mass of the electron, you know, how heavy electrons are, or the charge of the electron, or the strength of the gravitational force, or the strength of the electromagnetic force. And if you changed any of these by just a fraction, just a teeny little fraction, life would be impossible. And so there have been people who have made design arguments from constants in nature that science has discovered, and thus these arguments are incorporating scientific material to argue for the existence of God. So even though they're normally classified as philosophical, they do incorporate modern science. Now let's take the other possibility of if we're asking, does God have just spiritual life, or does he also have biological life as well? Well, Jesus is biologically alive. He's got a body. It's got functioning metabolism. So he's physically alive. He's biologically alive. But as far as we know, the Father and the Son don't have biological bodies, and so they would not be biologically alive, but they would be spiritually alive. They would have spiritual life. And in fact, they're the source, together with the Son, of all spiritual life.
And Shannon, thank you. That brings us to the break. It's an Ask Me Anything episode with all the questions coming from the internet. We'll continue with Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN Publishing has great summer reading. Dr. Ray Guarendi says teens are full of life, enthusiasm, energy, and laughter. In Standing Strong, he gives parents the tools they need not only to navigate the teen years, but also to enjoy them. It's one of many great summer reading suggestions for you from EWTN Religious Catalog. For more, visit EWTNRC.com today.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guests. It's an Internet Ask Me Anything episode, and Shannon asked a question from her 15-year-old before we went to the break, and this one comes from her 13-year-old, who asked, in the Skinwalker Ranch episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, there were three wolf-like activities, and one of them was a wolf-like creature running around in the horse pen. One thing I realized was that the description for the wolf was almost the same as the beast of
Gévaudan.
Gévaudan. Okay. I'm glad I let you pronounce that. I wasn't going to come close. Do you think the beast could have been a skinwalker? They were both red, had puffy tails, head like a wolf, hyena-like bodies, and boar-like legs. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Okay, so just so people can listen to the relevant episodes, Skinwalker Ranch was episode 27, so you can go to mysterious.fm/27, and The Beast of Gévaudan was episode 297, so that's mysterious.fm/297. Skinwalker Ranch is a location in Utah, in the state of Utah, where a bunch of weird stuff has been reported, including some strange animals that look kind of like wolves, but are unusually big or have weird body proportions, like the one the 13-year-old mentions. The Beast of Gévaudan was a creature that appeared in the 1700s, in the mid-1700s, in France, in the Gévaudan region. And it violently attacked and killed like 100 people. And it was described as being like a wolf, but not a wolf. And there are more detailed descriptions. In terms of the question, could the beast that was seen on Skinwalker Ranch or the Beast of Gévaudan being a skinwalker? Well, a skinwalker is in various Native American tradition, a skinwalker is basically an evil wizard. And the evil wizard is, or, you know, evil sorcerer, evil magic user, evil medicine man who's able to change his physical form. And do bad stuff. And so that's where the name Skinwalker Ranch came from, because of the legends of local Native American groups of this area is in the path of one of these skinwalkers, one of these bad magic users. Could any of the beasts on Skinwalker Ranch have been a skinwalker in that sense? Well, it's going to depend on what you believe about magic and whether humans can genuinely change form. I'm very skeptical of that. I tend to think that although there are reports of people changing form, I have yet to find convincing evidence that that can actually happen. So I would be skeptical of the idea of a literal skinwalker being involved in either of these incidents, either Skinwalker Ranch or the Gévaudan region. If a related question is asked, could the you know, weirdly proportioned red wolf-like creature from Skinwalker Ranch have been the same thing as the Beast of Gévaudan was back in the 1700s? Well, it's possible, but that creature on Skinwalker Ranch did not display the most notable trait of the Beast of Gévaudan, which was it had no fear of humans and was very aggressive towards humans and would attack and kill humans. Whereas the beast that had the long legs but otherwise was kind of like looked like a big red wolf on Skinwalker Ranch ran off when humans approached it. So that makes it, their behavior is different. And even if we don't have an exact way to compare them physically, the behavioral differences between the two of them suggest at least that they would be different things.
All right. Thanks for questions from both of the youngins, a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old. Maybe we'll hear from you again, Shannon. Thank you. Let's go to this question from Matt. I remember a very helpful episode where you discussed the career of Dr. Stephen Greer. I have been very curious about what you know about the legitimacy of the UAP claims by Bob Lazar and David Grush.
And points to Cy Kellett for pronouncing Lazar correctly and not saying laser.
Oh, but that would be so cool. Oh, man, if his name was Bob Lazar, I would believe anything he says.
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of people won't be familiar with who these gentlemen are. Stephen Greer is a guy who's active on the UFO scene right now, and he claims to be able to telepathically summon flying saucers or UFOs or UAPs. And he even takes people out on expeditions where he'll claim to do this. And it's like, okay, we're all going to meditate together, and then the flying saucer's going to come. And in episode 194 of Mysterious World, I did an in-depth look at Stephen Greer and his claims, and I concluded he's a fraud. In fact, I have evidence that he hired an airplane to drop flares in the distance to fake UFO appearances. So I think he's a complete fraud. Bob Lazar is a gentleman who genuinely did apparently work at Area 51 back in the 1980s. And he was sort of the guy who brought Area 51 to public attention. He initially did it anonymously, but his identity was quickly revealed. He was working with a journalist who was actually a good UFO journalist in Nevada. And they called attention to Area 51 and some of the strange aerial programs that they have working out there. Lazar went on to claim that he had worked on a project that involved trying to reverse engineer a crashed flying saucer. And he made various claims about it using element, I believe, 118. It was one of the highest elements, if it wasn't 118. It may have been one of the others in that general area on the periodic table. And he claimed things about his history that have not been confirmed. Like, he claimed to have degrees from various places that have no record of him. Now, his argument is, well, the government disappeared my college records. So that's why there's no record of me having a degree from MIT or things like that. However, I am very skeptical of Bob Lazar's claims. And I actually did an episode on him. It's episode 22. So you can go to mysterious.fm/22 if you want to hear my my reasons for doubting Bob Lazar's claims. I don't have concrete proof that he's a fraud the way I do for Stephen Greer, but I'm very skeptical. David Grush is a guy who has come to public attention only recently, only in the last year. He worked for the Defense Department's UFO investigation program, and he was a whistleblower because what he said was, I talked to various people as part of my investigative duties who said, we have a bunch of crashed or abandoned flying saucers, including biological material, that are being hidden from congressional oversight. And he allegedly suffered reprisals for reporting this up the chain of command. He filed a whistleblower complaint that found his claims credible, that he did experience reprisals. And then he went public to talk about this, and he became famous for this. As far as I know, David Grush is an honest guy. I haven't seen any evidence that he's lying or faking, but all of the knowledge he has that he reports having of these matters is secondhand. It's just what other people have told him. And that means that the other people could be mistaken, or they could be disinformation agents. And so I can't regard what David Grush has claimed as being reliable until we get independent verification that's more than just hearsay, or more than just what somebody else says. We need to see, okay, bring out the goods, you know, show us these things if we've got them. They need to be under congressional oversight. And if they can be brought under congressional oversight, that would confirm what he says. But until such time as that happens, it's an interesting story, but I can't say it's anything more than a story.
All right, Matt, thank you very much for the question. Next time I will not miss the opportunity to pronounce the name Bob Lazar. I'm sorry. I didn't even see that one. This question comes from Dizzy Lizzy, which I do not know if that's a description or a name.
Dizzy Lizzy Cupcakery.
All right, Dizzy Lizzy Cupcakery. How can we better understand the word belief with regards to God and our faith? And do Catholics and Protestants, specifically Lutherans, understand this idea of belief in God differently? Is it just about saying you know of God's existence and profess to others that you know and understand of his existence? Or is there a deeper understanding of belief in God, which also calls us to act or respond to this understanding of belief in him? If there is a deeper understanding or action of belief, where do we find this in history and scripture or in the actual definition or meaning of the word?
Okay, so the term belief or faith, there are a bunch of definitions for this. And in the biblical languages, belief and faith are the same thing. We have two words in English, but it's really the same concept in Greek and Hebrew and Latin. And they get the term gets used several different ways. In a kind of a minimal sense, belief is just intellectually assenting or agreeing with various theological truths, like God exists. And that kind of faith will not save you. This is a point James makes in James chapter 2, where he says, you believe in God, you're doing good. But guess what? Even the demons believe in God, and yet they shudder at the prospect of his wrath. So merely intellectually agreeing with various theological truths will not save you. A step up from that is belief that incorporates trust in God, where we're trusting in God for example, salvation. And that's a theological virtue known as hope. So a step up from just intellectual assent or raw intellectual belief is a faith that incorporates hope or trust in God. Then a step up from that is an intellectual belief that incorporates hope or trust and love of God. And this is what's referred to in Catholic theology as formed faith, meaning faith formed or informed by charity. It's also what Paul refers to in Galatians 5:6 as faith working through love. And everybody agrees that if you've got formed faith, you're going to be saved. You know, that's clearly the teaching of Scripture. If you have formed faith, you are going to be saved. And because you love God, you're going to be acting on that love of God. You're going to be doing stuff. You're going to be doing the good works that God wants you to do and that He'll ultimately reward you for. So if you have formed faith or faith working through love, you're definitely saved. The question and the point of controversy between some Protestants, not all Protestants, and Catholics is, what if it doesn't have the love? Will it still save you if it's just trust coupled with belief? And you're going to find Protestants on different sides of that. Some Protestants are going to say, oh, all you got to do is believe in God and trust Him, and you don't got to love Him or anything like that or do good, nothing like that. On the other hand, other Protestants are going to say, no, Paul says what counts is faith working through love. You need the love too as part of your faith. In fact, the Protestant reformer John Calvin didn't even want to call something faith if it didn't include love. So you have a mix in the Protestant community on that. There has been a lot of discussion recently on the subject of salvation and belief and so forth with Lutherans and other Protestants that led in 1999 to the publication of a document called the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification, which was signed by the Lutheran World Federation and the Catholic Church. Subsequent to that, the World Methodist Council signed on, the World Anglican Consultative Council approved it, and the World Communion of Reformed Churches also signed on. So this is kind of a pan, it's not universal, but it's a broadly ecumenical document that says, hey, basically we agree on these core elements about justification. If you'd like to read the document and have additional commentary on it, you could check out my book, The Drama of Salvation. There's also a short little book I did called 20 Answers, Faith and Works that goes into the basics of a lot of this. And so you could check out that too.
All that you can find at Catholic.com or probably just about anywhere where good Catholic books are sold. Thank you, Dizzy Lizzie Cupcakery, for the question. And there's more of these, so we'll have to do this again. I like doing them, Jimmy. You'll do this again with us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Come back.
Oh, of course.
All right. That will do it for us this time. Check out if you're for all of your Catholic book needs and now Catholic gift needs and some fashion needs as well. You can find all that stuff at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, you can find all over the internet, but check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at mysterious.fm. Thank you, Jimmy. We'll see you next time.
My pleasure.
All right, that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time right here, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.